Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
I'm here today with Tim Grattan, who's going to talk us through the benefits and the pitfalls of EIS investing. Tim, thanks very much indeed for joining us. So tell us a little bit about your background and why you invest in EIS opportunities.
University, I did science, so I did 3 years BSc and then I did a 3 year postgrad, and then worked in the pharma industry for 25 years and left when
drug development.
Okay. And there was an opportunity to leave with a package and a pension, so I grabbed it. A bird in hand is worth several in the bush. I made my first investment in any stock market share in 1986, which was TSB, and I did a few privatizations after then and made money because it was very easy in those days with privatizations, and I was bitten by the bug and I've been investing ever since. I made my first tax-efficient investment where you actually get upfront tax relief in 2003, investing in a number of venture capital trusts where they give you 30% of your money back. So if you invest £10,000, for example, in a VCT, you would claim back £3,000 income tax. I did that for a number of years, but around about 5 years ago, sort of made a switch to from venture capital trust to enterprise investment scheme or EIS companies.
So what is an EIS?
Right, well, it was set up by the government. It was Michael Portillo, I think, back in 1994. And it was set up in order to encourage private investment in small, fast-growing companies, which will hopefully grow to large companies with lots of employees, which pay lots of tax. So the money which the government puts up front should be multiplied by many times in the future through getting taxes from employees and VAT and other taxes associated with employment. The government does not give all these generous tax breaks without a small catch. You're getting 30% back on what you invest. So if you were to invest £10,000, for example, you could claim back £3,000 income tax on the assumption that you paid the income tax. And there's a host of other tax benefits as well, which I'll talk about later. The 30% tax break is really quite generous, and they don't give that away without certain catches. And the biggest catch for anybody contemplating EIS is the fact that you actually have to retain these investments for a three-year holding period in order to maintain the tax relief. Should you sell before the three-year period, unfortunately, even though you may have received the tax break from the government, you have to pay it back. So I try not to do too much of that. I think in terms of the amount raised, it's been phenomenally successful. The government, I think, in the last year where there's a record, which was year ending April 2018, that scheme, there was £2 billion raised from private investors under that scheme, which I would suggest would probably be a lot less had it not been for the tax breaks.
So is there evidence to suggest that the £2 billion or so that's been invested in EIS companies has created growth in those companies in the way that the government had intended?
Yes, indeed. You've got studies which have been conducted by the EISA, that's the EIS Association, which shows that the government have been paid back manyfold, and also I think the venture capital trust Association has done similar studies. Venture capital trusts invest in EIS companies, and they've also shown that this is a good investment for the government long term. They get more back in tax in future years than they when they give us, the investors, initially. So, yeah, it's a good investment for government.
And we don't see it changing?
Hopefully not. You never know with an election around the corner. It could change. I hope not. It was set up in 1994, and it's managed to survive all colours of government so far with only fairly minor changes. It's always been upfront tax relief, and the other tax benefits have always been there. I think in the early years it was just 20% tax relief, and it's gone up to 30% in recent years. So if anything, it's sort of getting better and governments are getting keener.
So talk us through the tax benefits. It's 30% income tax.
Yeah, okay. So there's I think you could say there's six tax benefits in total. Some of these will appeal to different investors. For myself personally, the most important one is the 30% upfront tax relief, the income tax relief. But in addition to that, you also can have capital gains deferral. So if, for example, you had an investor who had sold a business and had £100,000 gain, which was taxable, if they made investments in EIS companies in that tax year, that would enable them to defer the gain until when they sell those EIS companies. So you're not eliminating a capital gains liability, but you're deferring it to a later date. And if at that later date you start to sell down your EIS stake, you can do so that you would just be selling it down, so only 10,000 or 11,000 becomes reappears each year, so you could use your capital gains allowance over 9 years in order to if you like, dissipate the liability on that 100,000 original gain, which I think some people do. The third benefit, which I have used before and I do find useful, is unlike ordinary shares, if you make a loss, you can offset that loss against income. For ordinary shares, you can only balance a loss with a gain. But in the case of EIS, if you lose, say, for example, you invest £10,000 in a company, which is EIS qualifying, you get your £3,000 back within months of the upfront tax relief. So your net investment would have been £7,000. If then the company, let's say worst case scenario, were to go bust, you would have lost £7,000. And the EIS rules allow you then to claim, if you're a 40% taxpayer, you can claim 40% of that £7,000 back for your income tax, or if you're a 20% taxpayer, it would be 20% of £7,000. So probably most people who do EIS are 40% taxpayers, so that would be another £2,800. So you would have only paid for this failed investment £4,200 at the end of the day, not £10,000. So that's useful. If you don't want to claim it on income tax, a loss, you can also, like any other ordinary share, just claim it against a capital gain. So the two would cancel one another out. And then another big benefit is all gains are tax-free. So if you're 10,000 shares, instead of going £10,000 worth of shares, instead of going down to zero, were to go up tenfold to £100,000, there would be no capital gain liability on that £90,000 gain. The last benefit is if they are held for 2 years, they become inheritance tax-free. So were you to die after holding an investment for 2 years or more, it would not be part of your estate for inheritance tax purposes.
And what about dividends? I suppose these aren't paying dividends.
Most will not pay dividends. I've purchased a few in the past which have paid dividends. A dividend is not tax-free. This is a difference between venture capital trusts, which a lot of investors do, which also have the 30% upfront tax break, and EIS. A VCT will pay tax-free dividends and EIS will not. So you do have to pay divvies on EIS companies.
And are there any other differences between a VCT and EIS?
Yes, plenty. The biggest one, which has put me off doing too many VCTs, is the holding period. For EIS companies, you only have to hold for 3 years to retain the tax breaks. For VCTs, it's 5 years, which suits some people, but I'd rather not have my money tied up for quite that long.
Any other differences?
No, they're both free of capital gains if you make a profit on them.
And what's the amount with an EIS? What amount can I, as an investor, put into it? And what amount can the company raise through an EIS?
Right, with EIS, our bountiful government, I think it was two years ago, raised the limit for individual investors from £1 million a year to £2 million. Apparently, though, there was only, in the days when it was £1 million, they were only getting about half a dozen investors who were claiming a tax back on £1 million. So I would imagine it's even less than that with £2 million. With other investments like venture capital trusts, the annual limit is just 200,000. Mm. So it's 10 times that amount. Mm. So I guess EIS appeals to the uber rich, whereas venture capital trusts would only make a small dent in their tax bills. In terms of the amounts a company can raise every year through EIS, I think, £5 million a year. And during the lifetime of a company, they can claim a maximum of £12 million. Once the £12 million has been invested under EIS, they have to revert. The money's run out. Mm. Unless they are knowledge intensive, as defined by HMRC, there's certain criteria, like the number of postgraduates employed by the company and amount of intellectual property. But if it's deemed knowledge intensive, their lifetime limit is £20 million they can raise under VIS schemes.
So what are the qualifying factors for an SME to qualify for EIS?
It's easier to talk about what would exclude it from getting EIS. So company has to have less than 250 employees. There's a gross asset test. I think after investment, it cannot be, the gross assets have to be, I think it's under 15 million. Certain trades are not permitted. So you wouldn't get approval for, if you're an oil explorer, or anything which is asset-backed. Mm. So property development, you won't get EIS relief. Farming. Renewable energy, unfortunately, that they up to about 2009, I think, 2010, you could get EIS relief for wind farms and hydroelectric plants, but that's been stopped. It's considered to be not risky enough and it doesn't create enough jobs.
So what they're kind of looking for is the unicorns of tomorrow, yeah, the high growth, techie type, bio type companies.
That's right. When they were set up in 94, the intention always was to promote high tech, unicorn type companies, but clever accountants and financial advisors found ways of using the rules and adapting the rules such that they were investing in more asset-backed investments, which still qualified under old rules, which had far more appeal for most investors than the techie-type risky stuff. Probably about 5 or 6 years ago, they started to nibble away on around the edges of the rules, making it more and more difficult to do asset-backed EIS. And this really culminated in, there were some big rule changes which came in 2017, 2018, following the patient capital review, which was a big review of all government subsidised investments, not just EIS and VCTs, which basically meant that going forward, anything which was asset-backed would not qualify. It means that the EIS and the VCT investment landscape is in the process of changing now. So anything where you want a tax break, it carries more risk. And the government believe that this is a better investment for them. It will lead to more unicorns, and they love unicorns. They wonder why they haven't got as many as the US or Israel or Canada in terms of, you know, the GDP of the country, and so they're trying to do something about that.
What types of EIS investments do you favour?
For a retail investor, there's three main ways they can get into EIS, I think. They can either go for a crowdfunding site. So you've got people like StockCube and Cedars, and there are others as well. They will all be unlisted companies, probably smaller than the ones which you get on AIM. In my opinion, some of the propositions out on those platforms look a bit overpriced to me. And I don't like unquoted, because there's no liquidity there should you need to sell. So that would be the first port of call for anybody considering EIS, I would suggest. There's then EIS funds run by fund managers such as Calculus, Octopus, Seneca, where you would subscribe, maybe it's normally 10,000 minimum, and they will go away and invest that in a basket of EIS shares, so maybe 5 or 10. Some may be AIM listed, some may be unlisted. They are associated with quite high charges. So annual running costs might be 2%. You've also, the companies are also have to pay a monitoring fee to the manager more often than not. So that's always a drag on their performance. But the thing I personally don't like is the performance fee incentive on some of these funds, where they'll often charge 20% of any upside, which I'd rather have in my pocket than theirs.
But they might argue that it's a risky area and that they can perform better than a mere mortal.
Yeah, they might argue that. There just seems to be a dearth of performance data on some of these funds. They generally launch a new one every year, so there'll be different vintages for each of the fund managers. And I've had difficulty in finding out what past performance is. They might highlight certain successes, but the failures aren't so easy to dig out. But they'll have them. The third method, which is one which I certainly favour, is to just invest in AIM-listed and NEXT-listed SMEs, of which probably if you sign up with a few private client brokers, which costs nothing to sign up, I'm getting about 20 opportunities a year to consider. And I probably invest in about 10 of those. And I like AIM and NEXT because they tend to be larger, safer companies. You've got more often than not much more transparent reporting. And very importantly, if you decide you don't want to remain invested and you're willing to forfeit any of the tax breaks, you can sell whenever you want. Also, that applies to if you hold for 3 years, you can sell whenever you want and retain the tax benefits. That is more often not the case for the former two. For unquoted crowdfunding ops, they'll all be unlisted and you can't sell till the managers decide they want to sell the company. And likewise with the with the funds, it really is up to the manager to time the exits for the components of a fund. So it's the liquidity aspect which I find very attractive. And there is one other advantage, I'd say. With AIM and NEXT, if most of my investments in that area are placings, there's some IPOs, but mainly placings. And with placings, you will invariably get a discounted price compared to the prevailing market price, which can be it can be very large. There was one this week which I participated in, which was about a 60% discount.
Is it public knowledge yet which one it is?
Yes, it is, C4X.
Ah, what do they do?
It's pharma, another baby pharma. Add that discount to your 30% discount you're getting from Her Majesty's government, and that becomes, that gives you a very big safety net for future losses.
Yeah, excellent. So. And do you have a view on the change of NEXT Markets now, the ownership's changed?
Yeah, I think it's probably going to be for the better.
Yeah.
So it's going to become more liquid.
Yeah.
And certainly I'm picking up that more companies are beginning to contemplate NEXT as an alternative to AIM. So I think it's a great move.
Yeah, it's quite exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So companies that are EIS eligible have to register for EIS eligibility. Do any of them ever fall foul? So you as an investor have bought in as an EIS and then they haven't done what they need to do.
Yeah, okay. I don't, certainly in the AIM and NEXT world, this definitely does not occur very often. And I think the reason for that is that there is a procedure which they will go through called advance assurance of EIS eligibility. So any company contemplating raising money under EIS will normally get this advance assurance from HMRC. So there is a procedure for obtaining that. It takes a while and they obviously have to meet certain criteria, but if they have that, it gives the investor a lot more confidence when they invest that they will get the EIS tax breaks. And it also means that the company has done everything it can in order to comply, and it will know about the penalties which investors will suffer should they become ineligible and break the rules within the 3-year hold period, which the investor has to hold the shares. In the 5 years I've been investing in AIM and NEXT, there's only been one occasion where a company came very close to losing it. And that was because you are supposed to, one of the requirements is the company needs to invest for funds within a 2-year period. If it doesn't, it's in breach of the rules. And so there was one of my investments, Velocity Composites, which failed to do that. I think that was largely Brexit related. But even though it warned that it wasn't going to do it, to fulfill that criteria, it turned out it managed to get it deployed at the last minute, so it didn't lose its status. Much to the relief of myself and to a lot of the venture capital trusts who also invested in the company.
What are the other risks that are inherent with EIS investing?
Well, small and medium-sized enterprises, of course, are a lot more risky than large caps. And they're more likely to fail, and that's not just unique to EIS. Probably because EIS are doing more speculative stuff sometimes, whether it's tech or mid-tech, they are more prone to fail. But if they succeed, of course, the reward could be bigger. The other risk, I'd say, was it doesn't apply so much to AIM and next listed EIS, but certainly to unquoted, is the lack of information available on the company, because they don't have to report so much as a listed company. The corporate governance may not be as good because they don't have to comply to any stock exchange rules. And so those I consider more inherently risky than quoted companies, which is another reason, as far as I'm concerned, to stick to the AIM listed.
So what are your preferences for EIS opportunities? Where will you want to put your money?
The 20 or so opportunities which I see each year, I guess, tends to be a mixture of tech, med tech, biotech, and quite a lot of software. Seem to get a number of phone apps seem to be very much flavor du jour. You occasionally get traditional industries making widgets, but they seem to be coming less and less as time goes by. And I guess the new rules concerning asset-backed EIS start to bite.
So what's your preference?
My preference? Well, with a pharma background, I prefer biotech and medtech. I don't think it really gives me much of an edge in terms of picking big winners, but I think it might give me a slight edge in terms of avoiding the dogs.
Which is always what we want to
yes,
do.
Yes, indeed.
So looking at the performance over the 5 years you've been investing, talk us through sort of some of the dogs and some of the triumphs.
Okay, right, bad ones. I think probably a very recent bad example would be Motive Bio, which IPO'd about 4 years ago. I invested at the IPO. It was EIS qualifying. I think it was 17 pence a share.
And what appealed?
It was picking up where another company left off on the development of a novel antibiotic. The other company ran out of cash and they'd done all the clinical trials or some of the clinical trials. So the proposition was to buy the asset and do the trials necessary to complete the program they needed for regulatory approval. And they got all the way to submitting files, having run new clinicals, which looked quite good, but they failed on the last hurdle with some pretty tough FDA questions concerning liver tox. So that one is now sitting in my portfolio at 0.6p, having purchased for 17 pence, and it will sit there for a lot longer. Another one, different fields, CyanCanode. They are a company which is specialising in smart metering. It's a little bit in the UK with smart meter twos, but mainly in the developing world, and out of the developing world, India is the biggest market. They just seem to have had cash call after cash call, and the market's appetite for continuing to fund them to get to break even is, shall we say, waned a bit over the years. So they were purchased at 40p and they're currently sat at about 4.5p at the moment.
And if you went back to that, could you see what went wrong and would you have invested in it again?
In the case of Motive Bio, I probably would have. I think in the case of CyanCanode, probably not. I've had a couple go bust as well, or at least they've lost their listing and, you know, they're walking dead at the moment in unquoted land. So that's 365 Agile, which was launched on the hype of Internet of Things, if you remember that, a few years ago. And Sphere Medical, which was one of Woodford's little investments, say no more. That was a medical device which just required a lot more development than they were anticipating at the onset, and what they were declaring in the AIM admission document. And eventually they ran out of money, they delisted to save money, and then Woodford decided not to fund anymore. So they're currently in administration, and I'm not hopeful of the outcome there. Those are probably the main dogs within the portfolio.
So let's talk about the good ones.
Got some good ones. Probably the best performing one at the moment would be Zoo Digital. They've probably gone up about 8 times in 2 years.
Wow. What did you buy in at?
I think it was 9p and they're 80 pence at the moment. So that one's done well. They do dubbing and subtitles. It's software to help facilitate dubbing and subtitling. And it's a B2B business, so the main customers are big studios and TV producers. So that one's done well. Another one which has done well, which I must admit I wasn't very optimistic at the onset, is Scientific Digital Imaging, which is just as the name describes, it's scientific instruments. That has got a buy and build strategy. I invested in those at 10p, I think it's about 4 years ago. They're low 50s now, I think, so that's done very well. Interestingly, that is one which, under the new rules, would not qualify. It did 5 years ago, and it would not qualify because the funds are used for acquisitions, which are no longer permitted. But it served me well. And I've had there's some other good ones in there, not quite as high performing as those two, perhaps. But I'd single out Blackbird, which is a video in the cloud solution. So that one's very good. Integumen is a service provider for pharma. It's a software solution to assist pharma in testing drugs through skin. So we've got some big pharma clients in there, and that's gone up two or three times, I think.
So is your win-lose ratio getting stronger with the experience that you've got?
I think so. It's difficult to monitor completely, but I think I'm getting better at avoiding dogs.
And your level of research, are you doing discounted cash flows and doing models and going really in depth, or are you just getting a sense of what they do and the margins and what their forecasts are. How much work are you doing on them?
Okay, if it's a company you are completely unfamiliar with, you might only have a day to do due diligence, particularly if it's a placing. You get made inside and they will want to do the placing pretty soon after then, because the longer you leave it, the more the share price descends towards the placing price, as we, as investors know. So I find if, in terms of due diligence, if you are very, very short of time, probably the best questions to ask, in this round of funding, are the directors participating? And if so, how much? Are any existing cornerstone investors following their money, and are they participating? And more often than not, the cornerstone investors will be venture capital trusts. I pay attention to which venture capital trusts are invested or investing in this round in particular, because some are better, some are more selective than others. Not naming names, but some will do just about every opportunity which comes along, and others will be far more picky. So I'd say that Maven, for example, were fairly picky, and I would pay more attention if they were investing than if, say, one of the ones which has a scattergun approach and invests in everything. So those are the, if you're short of time, those are probably the best questions to ask. There are occasions when opportunities come along where you've done an earlier round, in which case I probably know the company quite a bit better and I might have seen or heard them present. So I'm much better informed, and I generally feel a lot more comfortable in doing follow-on investments rather than maiden investments in these companies.
And generally the follow-on is also EIS qualifying?
Yeah, I wouldn't touch it otherwise. If a company qualifies once, it knows the criteria, and unless it's grown phenomenally, it will probably qualify again.
And when you're that familiar with a company, what depth of research have you then done? Do you have models of absolutely what they're going to do? And
I generally would have a pretty good idea of and I'll have followed the company on its presentations, its video presentations it does, and I'll go along to investor meetings and AGMs if it's one I really like. A lot of it is just knowing the directors. Do you trust these guys? Do they know what they're doing? And the best way to assess that, I think, is to actually meet the management. So I do that whenever possible.
So net-net, over the 10 a year that you've been investing in for the last 5 years, winners, losers, what's the overall performance?
I'd say that most fell into a range of plus or minus 50% of the initial investment. But obviously I've had a few total write-offs and some multi-baggers. But if I disregard companies which I haven't held for the 3 years, which I invested and then decided to sell and I never made the tax claim, it's probably between 20-25% up, and that's not taking into account tax relief.
So well worth doing.
I think so, yeah.
And of the ones that you sold out before the three-year period, what's the motive for selling there?
I tend to do more EIS every year than I need to claim my income tax back. Not that I pay a lot of income tax, but that then gives me a choice of which ones to put forward to HMRC to get the tax
PI
back.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest.
Invariably, I have a small surplus of
shares. They do not
shares,
constitute
which I invested
any kind
originally
of recommendation
for
or inducement to buy shares of any company.
Sometimes I hang
PI
on
PI
to
World
them because I like them, and other times
kind
they get
advice,
sold.
And, nothing
and there's
in
a
our
few examples where I invest and I think I don't like this as much as I thought I did. I miscalculated. they are top of the list for disposal as well.
Tim, thanks very much indeed.
Well, thank you, Tamsin.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.